This interview is with Ninad Shinde, who's a valued member of my ValueX community. Ninad also counts as one of the very few people that I know who has genuinely lived, studied, and worked in three different continents or three different zones of the world. In Ninad's case, he was born in and grew up in India, where he did his first degree. And then he continued to the United States, where he did a second degree at Purdue University. He was also a student at Cornell before working in consulting in Boston, and then moved to London via London Business School, and has continued to work in the financial industry and in consulting. His day job is as a consultant to private equity firms, and through that he gets exposure to a large number of different kinds of businesses that are being looked at closely by private equity firms. But then Ninad also has an additional interest, which is public market investing. And in particular, Ninad has really had, in a certain sense, the freedom, not to mention the insight and the clarity of mind, to be able to sort of grasp very thoroughly the opportunities that are afforded to us by these new business models around the cloud and software as service and internet as service. And he kind of sees, I feel like he's seen far sooner than I ever did, the transformational nature of these businesses, and has a very good approach as to how to invest successfully in them and how to analyze them and how to manage one's portfolio risk around them. And so he's somebody that I've learned an enormous amount from. I hope you enjoy the conversation with Ninad Shinde. So hi, everyone. This is Ninad, and with him is his pet dog, Finn. And we're going to start with Finn, because we don't know how long Finn's going to stay on Ninad's lap. But before you introduce yourself, Ninad, why don't you introduce Finn? And maybe you can lift him up so that we can see. Oh, there we go. What a beautiful dog. He's not interested. Tell us about Finn.
Sure. So this is Finn. He's a Jack Russell Terrier, as you can see. He's 5 years old, or rather he will be five in March. I've had him since he was 8 weeks, and I've seen him grow, and he's my best friend and companion, and he's very fun to be around. He's also a ladies man, turns out.
Is that right?
Good wingman.
In any case, I should move on to other topics. We'll see how long we get to keep Finn. For those of you who are just listening, Finn is kind of alternately gazing at the screen and elsewhere. Don't feel obliged, Ninad, to keep him there. But so Ninad, I get to ask questions on these podcasts that I don't get to ask in real life, and or I would be uncomfortable. And I feel like you're one of the very few friends and people that I know who span at least three continents. And I know that there's an Indian component to your life. There's certainly a European and British component because you live in the UK. But Ninad studied at Cornell, which is in the US. And so I kind of can identify with Ninad on these different levels. And I'm hoping that you can just like explain to me and anybody who doesn't know you how you ended up with that diverse background. And maybe there's other elements that I even don't know about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there's a meme that I saw about this a few weeks ago, which is quite typical for many Londoners, and actually even if you're a New Yorker. And the meme goes as follows: when someone asks you, where are you from? You have four options. You can either say which country you were born in, you can say which country you went to school in, you can say which country you lived in, or you could provide a 10-minute history of your family.
Well, that's not a meme. That's a fact of life for so many of us.
And when I was younger, I thought I was the odd man out. But actually, it's probably also self-selection. The people that I know are people like me who sort of live life on a few different continents and done a variety of things. And frankly, it makes life a bit more interesting.
Ninad, I want the 10-minute family history, please.
Sure. I'll give you the version of it. So I was born in India, in Mumbai, or Bombay, as it says on my birth certificate. I spent a fair bit of my life in India. And obviously, like, you know, being in Bombay is a metropolis. It's the commercial hub as well as the sort of the entertainment hub, and probably the closest thing to New York that you can find in India. And it's always had that sort of an outward looking, the frontier of the country, if you want to call it that. So I spent my life there. I went to school there. And then over the course of my life, went to university. In fact, I started off university in a small town outside Bombay, going to a four-year engineering college. I never really thought that I fit in India. And this is also a vein that we can mine at some point if it's of interest. But I never really culturally assimilated in the country of my birth. And I felt that I belonged somewhere else. And the first place that I wanted to try out was the US. So I moved to the US to go to engineering school. I actually started out at Purdue. I started off in one of the toughest engineering programs there is in the US. I started off doing mechanical engineering, but over time, I transitioned to doing semiconductors, so learning how to make sort of computer chips in semiconductor fabrication facilities. And one thing led to another, and I ended up at Cornell, where I was doing some research on how you could use the techniques that are used to manufacture semiconductor chips to make what was called lab on a chip devices. So these are devices that are used for drug discovery and various type of tests. And actually, if you look at the LFD tests that we take nowadays, those are actually lab on a chip devices. There isn't an electrical component to it, but there is some, the way those tests are manufactured have a component of the kind of work that I used to do back in the day. So that's an interesting sort of side note. While I was at Cornell, I was working on a PhD. I met a group of people who were working on developing a device using this, what you call lab on chip technology and a bunch of nanotechnology, to come up with a way of discovering drugs rapidly, so increasing the throughput of drug discovery. So I was employee number 11 at a startup called Advion Biosciences, which was based in Ithaca, New York, which kind of was the demise of my PhD because I was so enthralled by the idea of working on this chip-based device that could lead to faster drug discovery and development that I kind of quit my PhD. And I started working on this. I helped develop the chip, launch the chip. And now actually, if you look at drug discovery labs across the world, some of the devices that I helped develop are being used sort of at a mass scale globally in drug discovery and development. So that was, let's just say I peaked very early in life and it's been downhill since then.
So just to pause a second, I just the first thing I hear think about when I hear lab on a chip is Theranos, and so can you just take a short moment to distinguish between lab on a chip and Ms. Holmes from Theranos?
Yeah, absolutely. So lab on chip essentially takes what you would do using large analytical devices, which tend to be about half the size of a room and literally cost $1 million each. These are things called mass spectrometers or liquid chromatographs or other kind of devices. And it shrinks it down to a very small device, which is fast, which is cheap to use, which can be used anywhere. I mean, the right energy is the LFD test that we take. Is you can take an LFD test anywhere in the world and it works just as well. And the trick to it is to make the components very small. And there's some physics behind why that actually makes sense. But what it ends up with is a device that is cheaper and much more effective and much more efficient. And it gives you results very quickly. So it scales up whatever you're doing, whether you're discovering drugs or whether you're seeing if a certain protein functions in a certain way. It lets you do that much faster with less human intervention you can introduce robotics, which is kind of what we did. So it takes away the scientist as a whole, and it replaces it with a mass throughput machine.
So LFD is lateral flow device, presumably.
That is correct. Yeah.
As in lateral flow tests for COVID. But just to then I want to rewind. So you had me at Mumbai, and so Mumbai, and you mentioned a university that I didn't get the name of. That can you just tell us briefly about that university?
Yeah, I went to a university called the National Institute of Technology, which is slightly different from the Indian Institute of Technology. I wasn't smart enough to get into the Indian Institute of Technology. Indian Institute of Technology, there's about five or six of them, I think, in India. And I believe there's something like 100,000 people or kids who apply for that. And it's incredibly difficult to get into those schools. And actually, you probably are aware of the fact that Monish has an organization, Monish Babrai has this organization called Dakshina, which helps students get into the IITs. So, I just knew from the start that I wasn't smart enough to do that.
Well, I was for a short while. I was on Monish's advisory board for Dakshina, and it seems to go from strength to strength. But in Mumbai, and sorry, do you speak Hindi or Marathi or?
I do, and kudos to you that you actually know Marathi exists as a language.
As a word, not in any. I don't know any words in Marathi. And did you?
Did you grow
up with Ganeshas around?
I did, because literally Bombay is sort of home to. There's a day called Ganesh Puja, which is basically the culmination of I think it's a 10-day festival, where there are idols of Ganesh that people go and worship on a daily basis, and there's a lot of food and drink and song and music and so things of that nature, a lot of dancing in the streets, and then they immerse the idol on the 10th day in the Arabian Sea.
So first of all, Ganesh is it's one of the Hindi gods, as I understand, and looks like an elephant, and it's the god of plenty, I guess. My favorite one is Shiva Nataranja. I just really enjoy this imagery around that. But so you see, I'm moving far slower than you, Ninad. Is there anything? So you felt like you weren't destined to live in India, but now, and for the listeners' interest, Ninad now lives in London. Is there anything? So we still need to get the transition from the US to, if there was anything in between that, to London. But the person you are today, what do you take with you from India? What remained as a part of you, and what did you discard? Or can you name some things in those two categories?
Yeah, absolutely, with a great deal of clarity. So I think the thing about being Indian was vibrancy. I mean, there's definitely, living in India, it's a very colorful place, both in terms of actual color and in terms of people and the variety of, variety of cultures, etc. And even living in Mumbai, I think people don't realize this about India, but it is a subcontinent, and it's quite balkanized. And if you go to the next state over, people speak a different language and dress differently and eat different types of food. So it's like a mini cosmopolitan center, which is just a melting point of cultures. And also because of the fact that it is so open, or at least has been in the past, to various religions, to people from different parts of the world, because of the business component, you would see people from all over the world that have assimilated and become part of that fabric. And for me, that was sort of, it was an optimistic city that I grew up in. The city always looked forward. It never looked back. It never slept. There was always something going on. So that energy has always resonated with me, and I take it with me to this day. The other thing, I guess, as an Indian would be the fact that culture and values, in terms of what do you value in life. So family, education, respect for elders, not necessarily in a being subservient to them, but in the fact that they have seen a lot, and just respect for people with expertise. in different areas in life, we've seen things, respect for wisdom and sort of a hunger for wisdom. I think that is quite an Indian cultural trait, probably in many Eastern cultures for that matter. And, you know, I like the fact that that has stayed with me and it has grown with me and compounded over time. And then I think finally, I would say just, you know, the ability to adapt, because nothing is a straight line in India. And you spent some time on your own and with Monish in India, and you know that even if it is as simple as, and this is before we had the convenience of cheap modern airfares in India, if you wanted to get from one part of the country to another, you would take a train. And you could take a fast train, which would get you there pretty quickly, but sometimes the train was overcrowded or you couldn't get into a certain carriage or you couldn't travel first. So you have to find ways to make it work. And as a teenager, as a student, I backpacked all over India, and you learn to adapt, you learn to do with less, you learn to take, to turn straw into gold. So you're always hungry, you're always looking for ways to take the very little you have. And it's a very competitive country. There's so many people and there's so many smart people who are good at school and other things. Well, I talk about academics primarily because that's kind of how my life turned out, was academic in nature. And India is not necessarily known for being best at all sports, as an example. But when it comes to academics, you're competing with some of the smartest brains. And if you aren't at the top of your game, it's very difficult to be successful. So I guess that the healthy competitive streak has stayed with me, where the world is a bit binary in terms of whether you win or lose. I mean, it's evolved over time, but I mean, I'm glad that I started off life on that in that footing.
I would just tell you that I used to tell people when I lived in New York City that I felt like just walking the streets of New York City was an education in humanity. And I used to love the idea that you could be a camel in New York and walk into a Starbucks, and so long as you can say I'd like one cappuccino and pay the money, the person serving the coffee and taking the money wouldn't bat an eyelid. They just didn't care because there's so much diversity. But I was just blown away by the diversity in India. And I think that to live in India is an education in diversity. And there are dozens of religions that I've never heard of that are all thriving in India. And if you take a look, they probably have tens of millions of adherents. And that kind of like, I feel like there's two places in the world that I know, probably China's one as well, but India and Brazil are kind of, they're universes in themselves of humanity. There's, you know, they say there's more genetic diversity in Africa than in the rest of the planet. And so people think, well, Africans, aren't they all just dark skinned? And the answer is no. Vast differences between East and West Africa, same with India. But so you arrive in the US as a student, basically. Mm-hmm. And And so tell us a little bit about what that felt like. Less competitive than India, maybe academically?
Well, it's interesting because when I graduated university slightly early. So when I arrived in the US, I was actually, as I was doing my research in grad school, I was employed as a teaching assistant. And I found myself teaching my peers or people who are older than me, which was fun as an experience. But, you know, I think the thing was that I had come in with an open mind. I had come in with sort of, I'd been to the US prior to that because I do have family that lives there. But I came in with an open mind, and I was hungry to learn from about what there was to learn in the US, but also being a highly rated engineering university, we had students, the majority of the students were international. So it was amazing to be in that environment. My thesis advisor was Chinese from Taiwan. I had another advisor who was Pakistani. And my third thesis advisor was German, or rather Austrian, if I'm not mistaken. So I got the best of all worlds. And then my classmates were Americans and Turks and a few people from the UK. A fair number of Chinese and Indian students. So, I mean, it was you know, a melting pot. I did feel challenged because it was a top five engineering school, and even taking three classes a semester and doing research and teaching a course on the side, an engineering freshman, sophomore course on the side, was a lot of work. I got very little sleep. And in a way, it was a bit of a cultural shock because the Indian academic system tends to be you work for the whole year and then there's a big exam at the end. And then you either do well at that exam or you don't. And I'm used to that sort of, you know, just having fun for the whole year and then cramming like crazy in the last month and then doing well on the test. Whereas the American way is more of, a Socratic way of learning with a large number of labs and a large number of midterm assignments and projects and so on and so forth. So that was a bit of a different challenge for me, but I think I adapted. And it gave me a chance to try different things. I mean, I took courses in mechanical engineering and industrial engineering, and then that's when it clicked that I really was interested in semiconductors. And I made that transition to, I found a thesis advisor in the electrical engineering department and ended up working on semiconductors. But I think culturally speaking, I mean, I was having a ball. I mean, part of the not sleeping was because options where I could sleep or I could go and have fun with some people. And I was just drinking from the fire hose. Mm. So I think those were some of the best years of my life.
So there's two transitions I want to explore. And I need to ask you, was there anywhere, now you're in London, was there anywhere between the US and London or a geographic transition that we need to explore? Or
Not as such. I mean, even when I lived in the US, I traveled a fair bit. I did spend a fair amount of time in Canada for work, but I mean, it's more of the same, although the people are nicer.
So can we go to the transition from the world of academia to the world of business, maybe that's the next transition logically.
Sure. So, I mean, I worked for this, as I mentioned, at this startup for a while, and I think it was about 2.5 years. I lived in Ithaca, New York, which is a beautiful place in the summer and in fall, but the winters are horrific. But we got to a point where the device was ready. We'd had VC funding from some of the best venture capital firms in the world. And once the device was successfully launched, the VCs wanted to sell the business. So I had a decent exit with this company. And then I realized that what I had been doing until that point was fairly engineering based in a lab or wearing a clean room suit in a semiconductor fab, making these devices. And I knew nothing about the world of business or finance. So I did what most people do. I decided I wanted to become a management consultant.
I know all about that.
So I quit my job in Ithaca and I moved to Boston, where I joined a boutique management consulting firm, where all we did day in, day out was work either with large companies or eventually with private equity firms on helping make the companies that they acquired more effective, more efficient, and more profitable. And I probably was, I think, 24 or 25 at that point. It is daunting. I'm sure you've heard, as a consultant, you know, there is this fear of being found out as not really knowing anything about this company and this industry.
Imposter syndrome
is the term, exactly. And you fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
And it's a scary prospect as a 25-year-old to be standing in front of a CEO and trying to tell him or her what's wrong with his or her business and how to motivate his workforce to get 10% more out of the company. But I mean, you know, nothing like that. Those were also, I think, sort of the formative years of my life where, I mean, by the time I was done with the first phase of what I was doing consulting-wise, I felt confident that I could walk into any company in one of, you know, 5 or 6 different industries and use a very first principles approach to diagnose what needed to be done to make that company do better.
Right. And that's actually the kind of work, well, at least part of your life today is still mm-hmm. consulting to those kinds of businesses, isn't it?
That's correct. So I started off doing that with Fortune 500 companies eventually transitioned to doing that with PE firms, and that's sort of what I do today. There was a brief time when I was an investment banker. We can talk about that.
PE meaning private equity, just that you know. Ninad has picked up an Americanism, which is to assume that everybody knows all of the acronyms. But so what drove the transition from Boston, and how was Boston, to London?
Mm-hmm. So if there's one place where I would not think twice about moving back to, that would be Boston. Boston has a very special place in my heart. Those are the best 6 years of my life that I lived in Boston. You know, you've lived in Boston, so you know. What
they call it the Athens of the United States.
And
where did you live? Where in Boston did you live?
So I lived in the Back Bay. I lived right by the Prudential Center.
Of course.
In one of the high-rise apartments called the Avalon. At Boston, which is sort of between 111 Huntington and the Prue.
Yeah, beautiful.
It was beautiful. I mean, great views across my first apartment. I could see Fenway Park all the way from my just from my bedroom window. I had great friends, good neighbors. You know, Boston is, you know, like they say, a mini New York in a way, where you get everything the world has to offer and then some, you know.
That's the way I feel about Zurich, by the way, but that's a whole other story. So why leave that wonderful city? What allure did London have?
Well, it was the go-go days of 07, 08, prior to the crash. And I had the brilliant idea of leaving my job in consulting to get an MBA so I could become an investment banker. And make a lot of money.
And that's the London Business School part of it.
That's correct. So I thought it was going to be just a short hop across the pond for a couple of years and then back to New York or something for a job in investment banking. But, you know, ended up staying here.
And so you know, I have this love-hate relationship with London. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious to learn about, without prejudicing you, I'm curious to hear about your relationship to London.
It is a love-hate relationship, I have to say. There are things about London which are incredible. If I were to list them, one, it's cosmopolitan. Two, there's a lot of opportunities here for business or otherwise, culturally, probably a world capital, one of maybe the top five places in the world where you could want to be culturally, brings in the best and brightest. So easy to get anywhere in Europe or even the Middle East. I mean, travel from here for the weekend. I mean, would you rather go to Scottsdale, Arizona from New York, or would you go to Saint-Tropez or Mykonos or, you know, you name it, for a long weekend? You can't compare those two. I think, you know, getting away from the US was good because I spent about 13 years in total in the US. And I felt that even though I came into the US with a very open mind, I felt like I was being herded down a certain way of thinking. The US is good about, and I love the US. I mean, I'd move back there at some point in my life. It's great at helping people assimilate. There is a pressure on when you come in as an immigrant that you bring your culture with you, but you assimilate into society and you come up with something new that's a melting pot. But then after a while, a period of time, I think there is this huge pressure to also conform. And some of the things that we conform to and some of the norms that have grown up in the U.S. are primarily because it's just so cut off from the rest of the world, and it's in a way sort of shut off to anything new that questions the way in which it has worked. And we see that a lot more sort of on the political in the political sphere nowadays.
You talked about Fenway Park, and this does not originate with me, but it's just hilarious that the biggest championship in a sport like baseball, which is pretty much only played in the US and a few other places, called the World Series.
It's a running joke. Exactly. Exactly.
You know, and by contrast, cricket, which is played by more people in more countries, they would never make a claim like the World Series. You know, it just wouldn't happen.
Yeah. So that, and even if they did, it actually includes people from different continents. So.
Yeah, you could say that baseball, I mean, they play baseball in Japan, I know, but the World Series doesn't include Japan.
Yeah. They need to have their own series.
Yeah, but so but what are the biggest downsides for you of London?
Well, I mean, for certain, sort of Brexit hasn't been great for the country as a whole, but that's a topic that you can double click into and talk about endlessly. Yeah. Without trying to, you know, get too political, I mean, I think the government has lost its way and the political system has lost its way and it has forgotten the, let's call it the common man. And it's become arrogant to the point where, you know, they think they can pull the wool over, people's eyes and people don't get it. And, you know, it's interesting that England has never really had a revolution as such. Over centuries, and it's always been a negotiation between the people, the public, and those in power. And what I see today, I don't really like what I see today in the way people are being treated.
So thank you for your history. I really appreciate it. And let's leave it all behind and move into what are the topics of my biggest curiosity with you. And so the listener should know that I met Ninad through my ValueX conference, and Ninad at the conference, the part of Ninad that we see the most is actually his stock picks and his ideas about public equities. And so we're going to segue into that. But before I get there, I want to just test and see. There's a company that I looked at yesterday called Basic Fit that was formerly owned by 3i.
Right.
And... I guess just to stay with private equity for a second, I mean, I know that interests in larger private equity owned companies are traded between private equity funds, and people like you and probably others like you work on those companies, and they're kind of known entities, even if they're not publicly traded.
Yeah.
And so... how important, you know me quite well, Ninad. How much am I missing by not focusing on that universe? We know that when, I don't remember the names of the regulations, maybe it was Frank Dodds, came in the US, there were many companies that had thought of going public that didn't. And there's the argument that it drove many companies that ought to have been in the public domain or in with publicly traded shares into this kind of semi-private state where they're not owned by one organization. And there's a universe of them. And then every now and then, some of them go public. And yeah. And could you just spend, you know, like a sort of like a short kind of primer on that universe for those of us who don't know a lot about it?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, the one thing to notice that private equity, their model has evolved fairly significantly over time. I mean, if you go back to the dark ages of the 1980s and barbarians at the gate, the type of businesses that they would acquire were very different from the kind of companies P firms acquire today. So the model, I would say, up to 2008 was to buy businesses that grew at sort of 2% a year at inflation and had a steady cash flow, and you can lever those businesses up. And as long as they paid off the debt or the interest payments, that was good enough. And you exit at a slightly higher multiple because the business has grown over a period of time. And equally, your equity component has done quite well because of the debt that you've taken on. So that was a pretty straightforward model, as we know. GFC changed that and threw that into disarray, primarily because by the time we got to...
Sorry, GFC is Global Financial Crisis. Continue.
Not to be confused with KFC. That's correct. Which threw that model into disarray because as we got closer to 2008, those companies that they were acquiring were being acquired for higher and higher multiples because debt was just so cheap back then. Various forms of covenants, which were not as restrictive as they used to be back in the day. I think over the financial crisis, I think PE firms pivoted and then they started buying businesses that were better businesses. And there always is a market for fixer-upper businesses and turnaround cases, or what we call buy and build, where you aren't really doing a whole lot other than just consolidating an industry, and you're getting paid to consolidate an industry, which is a perfectly legal and a rational way of making money, as is buying a basket case and fixing it and flipping it, you know. But, you know, I mean, it's sort of the Warren Buffett quote, which, I mean, I might be butchering it by saying that, you know, when it comes to the reputation of the management team or the economics of the business, it's usually the economics of the business that wins. And I think that's what they tapped into, and PE firms started buying better businesses that were growing and were more plugged into the quote unquote the modern world. So what I mean by that is they stopped buying the RGR Nabisco's of the world or the mattress companies. There was a time when it was a joke that sort of Sealy and Serta were just being passed from one PE firm to another. But they started buying businesses in sectors such as electronic payments or more recently cloud and SaaS businesses. Equally, they started buying companies that had more of a brand attached to them. I mean, a good example is Canada Goose, which, you know, or Montclair, or they've done very well with sort of taking brands that were fairly local brands and sort of making them very global.
Well, here in Switzerland, Breitling is another one, a private equity owned.
Absolutely.
And it's kind of scary from a private equity standpoint, as best I can understand, because what private equity people are good at is modeling cash flows, which are extremely stable, and looking at things like paying down debt over a certain period and increasing margins by 1%. But if I look at, and it's not like I've looked at the accounts of Breitling, but what Breitling's done is that they've taken what might have been owner earnings or cash flow to pay debt, and they've made huge investments in the brand and with no guarantee that those investments would pay off. And my experience of the private equity crowd is that they're good with spreadsheets, and they're good especially with modeling cash flow waterfalls on various different tiers of debt.
Right.
But now you've got this kind of unconstrained variable of return on marketing expenditure, and that is not the kind of thing that private equity people want to do. But they seem to have done it very successfully with Breitling. I'm blown away. It's got a lot to do with the CEO. The CEO is an extraordinary guy.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I think they've learned from the lessons. I mean, frankly, if you look at the type of people that they hire, I mean, it used to be back in the day that you would do sort of 2 years at Goldman or Morgan Stanley or JPM, and then you would do 2 years of business school, and then you'd end up at a PE firm. So basically, the majority of intake was from was former investment bankers, but that's changed over time. And they do hire a fair number of people who are sort of management consultants who worked with sort of companies who understand strategy, understand execution. And then more and more, they've added what are called value creation or portfolio operations teams, which are typically veterans of industry who worked in a certain industry and know how that industry works, or who understand a certain topic, such as, for example, marketing, they're an expert in that area, or how to carve out a company from a larger conglomerate and make that into sort of a better performing firm. Or more and more recently, tech specialists who know how to take the tech platform of a company that is usually quite antiquated, outdated, and a bit of patchwork quilt, and convert it into sort of a more modern sort of modular stack, as we call it. So they've learned, they've made the effort. And frankly, this is not just small firms or specialist firms. We're talking about the biggest firms in the space, US, European, and Asian, that have made the switch to that actually adding value, as opposed to just doing simple things like 2% growth and cutting 10% costs, because that's not a bad strategy.
They would call what that would be called financial engineering. And
absolutely.
And in your consulting work, are you, because I know that at least one of the companies that you've talked about to me is very much in that add 2% and squeeze, make the assets work harder. But do you have any, do you also get work in that kind of true value add segment?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I look at the history of the companies that I've worked with, it used to be sort of working with aluminum can manufacturers, which was the kind of business that was a 2% growth business. There's only so many cans that are being used in the world. And you just make the factories perform better. You cut 10% of back office costs, and you could still get a good return on that kind of business. But more and more over time, I started working with companies that were already healthy and growing rapidly, where tech enablement was a big component, where brand was a big component, where bringing in robotics and machine learning and things of that nature was a lever on making the company work more effectively. And also the people component, frankly, because at the end of the day, you can run a can factory with a certain quality of, you don't need rocket scientists to run that, an aluminum can manufacturer. But if you are doing something that is slightly more complex today, you do need to have the right people within the business. And upgrading the component of people is an investment in the business. But that pays off quite a bit.
And so if we were to talk about the universe of private equity investors who are good at that true value add, maybe you don't want to name any names, but are there any names that you'd be willing to, people who you respect highly or people who you think are really good at it?
Yeah, I mean, so I work with a fair number of them, and, you know, I'm not calling out any names by exception. I'm pretty sure some of my other clients are doing just as well. But I mean, if I were to pick one or two, I mean, this company, this Advent and Bain Capital, who've done an amazing job with electronic payments as a sector. And then there are other companies like, and P firms like Apollo, who have stepped into something new, which is semiconductors, or they recently acquired Yahoo. And that's a very interesting transition that they have undertaken. Equally, I mean, if you look at some of the businesses that focus on tech, P firms like Warburg Pincus or Primera or Apax, for example, they've done a very good job of pivoting into tech. If you look at brands, I mean, companies like Carlyle, who used to own Montclair, or Bain Capital, who own Canada Goose, or Primera, who own Doc Martens, or Hugo Boss, and I'm missing a few, Golden Goose is another brand that they own. It's incredible to see what they've done, how they've learned from some of the mistakes of buying sort of nondescript brands. Back in the days, a lot of PE firms bought nondescript brands that didn't really do as well. But I think they've realized that it's better to pay up for a high quality premium brand and then make it a bit more global, grow it, make it more accessible.
And I guess, you know, at the time that I joined the consulting world, it didn't happen. But then shortly after I left, probably many of the management consultants started developing private equity arms. And I guess that was a classic example of the partners in the consulting firms getting together and saying, wow, you know, there's things we can do here with our strategic insights. And right. We never convinced the managements or the boards to do it. But if we could put some of our own money together, we might be able to do it that way. And I remember that Bain was one of the first ones with that. And I guess it's an interesting world because for all sorts of reasons. I mean, you have on the one end, you have very large publicly traded companies. On the other end, you might have family businesses. And we haven't yet gone into the entrepreneurial space, but there's this kind of place in the middle where it's a consultant's dream. And I have to say that I find it really ugly. There are some publicly traded companies like this where you kind of just see the, it's the vulture funds that go for it, where they kind of just, they're not sure how long the business is going to last, and they just hollow it out. Basically, they keep loading it up with debt. They don't reinvest too much, and they just squeeze it for all the cash they can get. One was, I think it was called Vitamin Shop. It's an American distributor of potions and lotions and pills and health stuff. And you just see the private equity firms, you know, you kind of like the equity becomes more and more of a stub, basically, which effectively was RJR and Nabisco. I mean, all the debt lenders were making so much money. In any case, yeah. It's a fascinating world. I want to get to, and we're only 1 hour into this, so but lots to talk about. Where you've really distinguished yourself at ValueX is this kind of commitment to an interest in these companies that, you know, the new economy, cloud computing, edge computing, a world that's been very hard for me to wrap my brain around because it goes against all the many good things that I learned early on in my career. And I just described it to a group of Indian investors in Calcutta, how there are some a microscopically small number of businesses that are so incredible that any smart capital allocator in that business will take every last penny that he or she has at their disposal and reinvest it with pre-tax dollars because the returns are just through the roof. And I realized that Amazon at a certain point when they were reinvesting huge amounts of money into Amazon Web Services was like that. And there are others that you, it's a world that you know way better than I. But perhaps can you share with me in the audience the transition that you made from consulting and, you know, helping assets sweat to discovering this world of, you know, total available market, very high returns on reinvested capital, the very unusual economics that you get in this kind of very small area. What switched the light on from you? Where did it start? How far down the journey are you? Without getting to the end point, because there's plenty to ask about the end point, but the transition is really interesting, I think.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, I was an accidental investor when I started out and still continue to be fairly amateur. I mean, I just manage my own money. But I mean, I remember having bought Apple and Amazon and Google back in sort of 2008, 2009. And I held on to it for a very long time, not really understanding those businesses at all or understanding sort of what I had done. So it was complete. It was a complete accident that I bought those businesses, but I did get a chance to see their evolution. And you know, I was one of the first consumers of those businesses. I mean, I used to watch. I used to remember being on the road, sort of in this is 2006, 7, 8, as a consultant, and not being able to find anything good to watch on TV. I would watch Netflix on my laptop, and I was one of the first people who used to watch Netflix on my laptop rather than getting the DVD sent to me in the mail. I bought the first iPhone that came out, the first everything that Apple has ever produced. I used to buy my books and my cameras and electronics on Amazon back before it was people actually ever did that. I mean, I think it felt natural to me, and I've seen that evolve over time, but you know, so have many other consumers of those products or people who got lucky and bought the stock. Really, I think the transition for me was when I started seeing, and this is sort of a quote that, you know, Buffett is ascribed to Buffett that he says that, you know, I'm a good businessman because I'm an investor, and I'm a good investor because I'm a good businessman. You know, so it sort of goes hand in hand. So I think one of the things that I have been fortunate enough to do is work with capital allocators, firms within their businesses, to see how those businesses can be fixed. How they could be improved and made to perform better. And we're talking about nuts and bolts, where you're actually looking at every single bit of the business. How are things done inside the guts of a company? And I remember distinctly having worked with a UK-based company, which was, they're one of the bigger suppliers of fruits, flowers, and vegetables to the grocery supers in the UK. They basically import these goods from all over the world, avocados and roses and plums and pears and so on and so forth. From all over the world, they package them and then they send them to Tesco or to Sainsbury or to Waitrose. So completely boring business, as it were. But one of the pain points of the business was not being able to do that rapidly enough and not being able to manage their inventory well enough, not being able to manage their accounts receivable, accounts payable in an effective manner, or where they had 3,000 different SKUs. SKU is a stock keeping unit of various type of flowers, bouquets, if you want to call it that. So Tesco wants a bouquet that has three daffodils, one rose, and one peony. And Waitrose wants a bouquet that has five roses and two lilies and, you know, some of the foliage that goes with it. That's a different SKU. And you have 3,000 of those SKUs. How do you keep those straight? How do you know how much, what is the cost of each of the, each bouquet, each type of bouquet? What should we therefore price it at? What sort of inventory do we have? And frankly, where the entire business was creaking was, and also sort of working capital. I mean, being able to pay your vendors who you source from, as well as getting your payments and your rebates from Tesco and the like, because that does tie up a huge amount of working capital and account receivable and payables. And the bottom line was they had an antiquated tech platform. Tech platform would be a strong word. They had some things held together by string and duct tape. And they were still doing their job, but it was open to so many issues. I mean, the system could fail. If it failed for one day, that would be an enormous hit to the business. If someone hacked into that system, that again would have been an enormous hit to the business as a whole. And when we were talking to the business, the main thing that I learned from one of my colleagues who works in this area was, instead of trying to upgrade the ERP, which they had some antiquated version of the ERP, which was on-prem, which is on-premises, which is installed on the company server. And you, in the old world, you pay a license fee to use, one-time license fee. And then you get some annual maintenance fee as the vendor of that ERP system. ERP is basically enterprise resource management software, which basically helps you manage your accounts, manage where your inventory is, keep track of your payables, receivables, so on and so forth. It does a variety of things. But the old school ERP was where an Oracle or a Microsoft would sell you, or an SAP would sell you ERP that was installed on your company servers using a license fee and maintenance fee model. And then in 2 or 3 years, when that software became updated, they would sell you an upgrade where someone would then have to sit down and upgrade all the software. And it would be a 6-month exercise at best to upgrade things, causing disruption to the business. And you had to own it. You own the asset. You own the software. What we pitched to them was something different, which was called Cloud ERP, which is you no longer have to buy an asset from the software vendor. You get access to ERP, which sits not on your servers, but somewhere in the cloud. On the vendor servers or on a third-party server like Amazon or AWS or Google Cloud or so on and so forth. And all you do is you pay a subscription model, a subscription on an annual basis, which actually has the effect of it becomes more of an expense on your accounting line as opposed to a capitalized expense, which is actually good for private equity firms if you want to get into the accounts. But that's not the main reason to do it. But what is the benefit of doing that is that anytime, so if you are the vendor of that ERP that sits in the cloud, you've installed that ERP at 1,000 different customer sites, not at the sites, but 1,000 different customers are using that. You get to see remotely how they are using that software. When you detect a bug in your software at one of your customers, you can fix that bug back in the cloud so that it affects all your 1,000 customers and they get the benefit of the learning that you have got from one customer. When you then start looking at things like how do our customers use the software? What sort of load does it put in terms of the amount of memory needed? How many licenses are needed? What sort of computing power is needed? You can learn from 1,000 different customers and then you can upgrade your software. And when you upgrade your software, and I'm simplifying this massively, the next upgrade you can silently push down, just like Tesla does over the air upgrades on its software for its cars. You push it through and immediately the 1,000 customers get a benefit of that. So it works as a benefit for customers. You're in a constant upgrade cycle. So it works both ways. You as the vendor learn very quickly from your mistakes, right? Just like when you're using your iPhone, it says, do you want to send this data back so that we can learn very quickly from all as many million users in the world that have an iPhone that use iOS about, you know, and we can improve the software quickly. That's exactly what it's doing. So both sides of the equation benefit from that. But the question you asked was around economies of scale. And this comes down to, once you have developed the software for a certain user, you don't go about customizing it for every single other user or customer that you sell it to. It's a one-size-fits-all solution to some extent, but with every new installation, you're not actually, as the vendor, increasing cost at the back end. The only cost that you need, you increase, is basically the few developers that you need or the cloud storage space for hosting that particular customer, or so on and so forth. From a scalability perspective, so basically what I've just described is a massively scalable solution. And then from a profitability perspective, you can do the math and we can talk about that specifically, where once the development costs have been put in, you just keep scaling up the number of users you have, and every additional user is marginal income that just falls straight to the bottom line.
Yeah, you've described scale economies, but there are also network economies and lock-in effect. So one of the questions I was thinking through as you were talking is, how does a guy who's an engineer who understands numbers go from that to being a kind of a Muji hypergrowth perspective of the valuation doesn't matter in this case? And it's very, I forgive myself for not. So if somebody, if I would have understood that a decade ago, I would have known that there are certain businesses that meet, you know, there's this incredible confluence of, you know, scale economy is the smallest part of it. It's these, network effects and lock-in effects with the customers. And you even described one that I hadn't realized, is that rather than being CapEx on the customer's side, it actually becomes an expense, which is tax deductible. So there are all these things pointing the same direction. And the rational thing to do is to not look at valuation and just buy and own it. I think that, and I forgive myself for not having done that at the time, because I had ingrained into myself this value investing ethos of, you got to look at the cash flows, you got to look at the asset values, and you got to pay a discount to those cash flows and asset values. But I had understood it with respect to Berkshire Hathaway. And Berkshire Hathaway, when I kind of analyzed them, has this aspect of, when you have zero insurance float and you can be reassured that you can invest that float at more than the risk-free rate of return, there's kind of an infinite quality to it. There's kind of like infinite growth available to you. Exactly how much you don't know, but you could easily come up with circumstances in which any price is the right price to pay for that business, and you just want to own it. And I think that that's the perspective that you've come with to these cloud/SaaS businesses. And there are other people in the value investing community who figure this out. And just, sorry, this is just me. I'm going to just do a mini rant and get it done with. Is this these people who think that value investing is not buying cloud businesses, for example, and playing some kind of, quote, cheap multiple, whereas all value investing is intelligent investing. And an intelligent investor who understands this very unique economics would be willing to pay a very, very high price and certainly would not be dumb enough to try and look for multiples of earnings or all sorts of kind of, it's not right to say outmoded, it's just that they're not applicable in that, I mean, who would have bought Berkshire Hathaway based on a simple price to earnings? Or who would have bought Berkshire Hathaway based on a simple price to book? And so it's the same thing. So that was my little rant. Thank you for listening, Ninad. And I get quite, it's quite tedious when people try and insist that this kind of, the investing we're about to talk about is not value investing, but you still have to apply it in the right areas to the right companies. And just to give one example, I'm reasonably sure that WeWork had people who were thinking that this was a tech SaaS business with the kinds of economics that you are talking about, but actually it's more likely to be just a simple real estate business and does not deserve that kind of pay any multiple. So where I want to go, and with your permission, I'll share this, at least the slide that I'm looking at. I mean, you've kind of like listed some cloud / SaaS businesses here in one of your slides to your presentation to ValueX Middle East.
Yeah.
But for every one of those companies, and obviously the ones that you've listed there are well known and highly valued, there are probably dozens that are want to claim that they're the same thing. And there's an enormous amount of adverse selection. If you buy WeWork thinking you're buying the next Amazon, you're not. Because there's and there are businesses like Uber, and I'm not sure if I can describe this well enough, but there are network effects up to a certain level, and then there are anti-network effects. And so there's this phenomenon where you have Uber versus Lyft, and actually once you've saturated the city, you get destructive competition between the two networks because every driver is switching between the two and every consumer is switching between the two. And you could end up driving margins for the network providers to zero. So it's very unusual and unique to the specifics of the network. So if you've decided you want to invest in the cloud / SaaS space and you don't want to make the mistake of buying a WeWork, do you have any heuristics other than read Muji's blog? And maybe you can just introduce Muji for a second because I have not.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, shout out to my main man, Muji. I mean, listeners should go check him out on the web. He's at hypergrowth.com. That's hypergrowth with three H's. And what Muji does is he's a network architect, if I'm not mistaken. He does this in his day-to-day job. But then he really gets how these businesses work, and he goes to every developer conference there is, and he listens to every earnings call, and he speaks with people in the industry, and he boils it down in a way that is actually makes sense to people like us. And he's been a tremendous asset to me and some of the people who like investing in this space. So I would highly encourage you to check out his blog and subscribe to his site. It's not that much. The ROI on it will be 1,000% or more.
I think there's an easy way to make a few remarks. I mean, what people get wrong was that, Philip Fisher was a growth investor. And if you go read his books, you'll see the value / growth component to how to think about the world. That's a good mental model to have. And, as I've argued on some of our chats recently, I think Warren Buffett was a growth investor because, he had the foresight to see how Amex and Coke and other companies would become global businesses and would experience massive TAM growth. So TAM is total addressable market. And when he bought the businesses, he happened to buy them cheap on the basis of, what they were trading for at that time on a book value basis. But then he probably had the foresight to see that these were going to be global businesses that would be 10 to 100 times bigger than what they were at that point in the 1970s, 80s, and so on and so forth. So I think Warren Buffett was a value investor. He was prudent in how he bought those businesses, but I think he was a growth investor. That's my take on things. I started like you being a very hardcore value investor, on balance sheet basis, buy things on a discounted basis. But I think my religion has evolved over time, and I haven't been dogmatic about religion. How did the evolution happen, or what do I look for heuristics wise? I think I learned many things from making mistakes, such as thinking like a value investor and saying, you know, well, Apple and Amazon, et cetera, are fully valued. I used to own all of these stocks and all up till 2015. And then I fell into the trap, including Netflix. And well, Tesla is a different story, but I did used to own Tesla. I still do. But I sold some of those businesses in 2015. And then I realized what an idiot I was. And luckily I bought it back within a year's time, and I continued adding to my positions. But, you know, if you take, so, you know, I think at the end of the day, you have to understand how those markets operate. So, I mean, Uber, for example, is a good example. I mean, I would never invest in a business like Uber because it doesn't have a moat around it. And all the network effects are local in nature. And I know in the US it's primarily Lyft versus Uber, but when you come to Europe, you see so many new participants, even in the London market, who are basically throwing away venture capital money at acquiring customers. And they will continue to do that and erode the dominance of Uber or Lyft in these various markets. So it's a race to the bottom. The same is true for, you know, where you say deliveries, for example, grocery deliveries and all these platforms that have emerged both in the US and in Europe. It's a race to the bottom. Someone will always want to do it cheaper to gain market share, even if it's detrimental to them. So it's a race to the bottom. It's a zero sum game. You're hurting each other in the process, but you know, VCs don't care and those companies don't care. So those are not the companies that I invest in. And I agree with you about WeWork. I mean, you know, well, if you want to buy real estate with that kind of play, go buy Regus, which is significantly cheaper back in the day compared to WeWork. I look for things where there's true innovation. So if you just take cloud and infrastructure as a service, which basically means instead of having servers at your company, you rent server space elsewhere, which is what AWS does and GCP or even Microsoft does nowadays. The way I think of the world is if you go back to 2010 or 2008 and you looked at sort of, you know, Gartner is a good source. Gartner and a few other, prediction and analytics businesses, consulting businesses, would have predicted what is the size of the TAM, or rather the total addressable market for cloud in 2020 and compared to what it actually is in 2020. Actually, it was in 2020. I mean, they were off by orders of magnitude. Same thing if you look at the iPhone. If someone said to you, "What will the iPhone be used for?" And people are like for browsing the web, for emails, for phone calls. But what is the iPhone actually used for today? So that kind of TAM is unpredictable. So what TAM compounds as new use cases evolve for whatever it is that you're doing. So a good example, let me try and find an example in the real world. People probably thought, the car was only going to be used, an automobile was only going to be used for certain reasons back in the day. But over time, people found more uses for an automobile. I mean, you know, it's not for only transporting heavy materials. It's you can use it to go on vacation. Or if you think of a better example, would be computers. Back in the day, we thought computers were only going to be used for maybe for space research and academics, and nobody would ever need to use a personal computer. Why would you do that? And that's changed. So I mean, so what I try to do is I look for mental models of technological disruption, and there are many of these that exist. And a good reference is Professor Carlota Perez, who's a professor. I can send you the link if you want to post it in your show notes. And she does an amazing job of studying technological revolutions. And I would urge
people to go listen to her talk and think of, and see how she describes the evolution, the revolution, or rather the fourth industrial revolution that we're about to see, which is anything and everything. If you look at from a, we haven't yet started to scratch the surface of digitizing things in the business world and in other areas. So if you look at infrastructure as a service, which is what we're talking about, you could have servers in your company, which is your private cloud, or you could rent space from AWS. And the benefits of doing that are enormous, of both to the people who are the customers as well as AWS. And I mean, we could go into significant detail over here, but let me just we talked earlier about sort of how cloud ERP is somewhat better than, you know, on-prem ERP. If you look at using AWS versus using your own servers, the benefits to you as a company are, well, it's cheaper, it's massively scalable. So a lot of businesses do not require server space in low months, but around Christmas time, for example, if you're an e-commerce site, you suddenly need to spin up all these servers. What are you going to do? Buy all that server space and all those servers and have it in a private cloud and not use it for the entire year, and then only use it at Christmas? I mean, that's a waste of money. Whereas Amazon will happily, at will, spin up those servers for you as and when you need it. I mean, basically, you can quadruple the amount of server space that you rent from them just with a flick of a switch. So that is one benefit. Cost-wise, it's actually cheaper. Now, there will be arguments, and Andreessen Horowitz, they put out a post talking about how, you know, the public cloud is more expensive than if you were to have on-prem servers and so on and so forth. It's an interesting piece. But I mean, that comes to how well you set your policies for server usage. It's the same as if you give someone a blank check in your company and say, hey, you can use whatever server space you want to. And if you're not running that efficiently, if you're not monitoring or policing all of that, then you are going to run into issues with costs. I mean, there's the pros and the cons that you have to dig into each of those topics. But I mean, what does it do at the supply side? I mean, how does it make the supply side better? Because, and these are entire talks, if you check out sort of the annual AWS conference that they have, and their talks are on YouTube and various other sources, you'll hear some of this. Because AWS is able to do this at scale, they have basically reinvented everything. They make their own chips, which work much faster than what you can buy off the shelf. They make their own servers. They literally make their own exhaust fans that are used for cooling down the warehouses because they use energy in a certain way that is more effective. They have their own dark fiber, which makes things faster, and so on and so forth. So they're basically able to do all of these innovations in the back end that provide higher efficiency for user needs, but do it at a fraction of what it costs. And I forget the exact number, but I think the number of times AWS has announced a cost reduction in terms of server space, I think it's something like 100 times, if I'm not mistaken, over the past 5 or 6 years. So they're doing that. And the anecdotal piece of evidence that someone mentioned to me was that, who actually knows this quite well, is that while they are reducing costs linearly for users, rather the price to users is reduced linearly, the cost that they incur goes down exponentially. And who gets to keep the difference is investors in Amazon and AWS.
So I'm just going to, for the person who can't click on the link that we'll probably have, I'm going to read down a list of companies that Ninad, I believe, is addressing. With your permission from your presentation, is that okay, Ninad, to do?
Yeah, that's fine.
And then I'm going to ask questions. So under the cloud SaaS heading, we have Amazon, Microsoft, Google, Cloudflare, Snowflake, Datadog, Salesforce, ServiceNow, Twilio, Okta, CrowdStrike, and I'm blanking team. The name of the team is the symbol. What's the company?
It's Atlassian, which is basically they make Jira.
Yeah, Atlassian, DocuSign, Fastly. That's then under e-commerce, we have Alibaba, Shopify, Airbnb, and a few others. I'm going to leave semiconductors behind. I'm going to leave insurers behind. And then in streamers/metaverse, we have Tencent, Roblox, Facebook, Apple, Netflix, Spotify, Roku. And there are a couple of others that I've missed out. But so this is kind of the universe that Ninad is talking about. And he used, or Ninad, you used Amazon Web Services as an example. But what I want to ask you is, imagine for a second that I come to you and I say, you know what, Ninad, I know that all these companies may still be undervalued, but I want the new ones. I want the ones that haven't yet made your list. And I want the ones that haven't made your list that aren't going to be duds, like some of the ones that we've mentioned that have, you know, we talked about food delivery perhaps. So if I told you that you had to come up with a list of the 10 companies that might one day easily make this list, but are not yet on it, how would you go about doing that? So like call it the B team that is waiting to be promoted to the A team.
Yeah, no, I mean, I would literally go and look at the portfolios, and this is more of a Western-centric view as opposed to, you know, China's got its own economy and different way of doing things. Which is also admirable what they do. But I would look at the portfolios of A16Z, which is Andreessen Horowitz. I look at Sequoia. There's quite a few of the VC firms that have done extremely well. I would probably not look at Tiger or Coatue or SoftBank, because I mean, they seem to be sort of just pumping up valuations and playing a bit of a Me Too game. I mean, not to, I'm pretty sure they know what they're doing, but how they do things is different from, I think, how sort of the old school A16Z guys do things. And I would look at the decacorns that they currently hold and why they hold those businesses, because I mean all of these companies that, you know, we've seen do well came from the same stable, you know. I mean, the heuristics for me, as you said, were I like things that have a huge and expanding TAM, a compounding TAM, namely things that the way I think of use cases, if I can use something for X, can I use it for Y and Z and so on and so forth, right? Can I use the same thing for different things? And that requires a bit of extrapolation and imagination. We may not be able to do that if we are not industry experts, but there are people out there who do it. And thanks to companies, thanks to outlets such as Spotify, you can listen to them talk about it in their podcasts, and they're sharing about it quite freely on their websites. A16Z has a great website with, you know, incredible primers on various industries, and they have a podcast. I mean, they have several podcasts. So I think 10 or 15 years ago, this thing didn't used to exist. But now it does. I mean, it's more of a marketing tool for them. I get it. But you still can learn and double click into these areas. So you can learn about companies that are tapping into compounding TAM. I like businesses that have, I don't bet on businesses that are single point of failure businesses. So Uber is a single point of failure business. I like companies that make picks and shovels. And, you know, obviously the analogy goes back to the gold mining rush, I guess, in California, where you could either be a gold miner and buy a plot of land and try to pan it for gold and you could find gold or you strike out. But if you were the guy who was selling the miner picks and shovels, or if you're the guy who built the railroads that all the stuff would get ferried across,
that's the business to be in. And, you know, I mean, Warren Buffett talks about that quite well in terms of, you know, being, you know, by the toll gate, by the toll road, as opposed to, trying to figure out which automobile company to invest in.
Okay, so, just to rewind, can you talk about why Uber is a single point of failure business?
Well, I mean, Uber's single point of failure is pricing, basically. It only succeeds when, it's price and convenience, I guess. So it's winning on convenience, we'll give it that. But if its price is higher than other alternatives that exist around it, then it's not going to work. So, I mean, for example, in London, we have the, we can get Uber, we can get Bolt. There are sort of three or four other services that have grown up. And it's essentially the people, the investors backing those businesses are saying, we are more than happy to fund your customer acquisition costs and your driver acquisition costs and subsidize that until you win a fair share of the market. So Uber, it's a street by street battle. Uber has to win globally in the 100 major cities for it to be a viable business. But any of Uber's competitors, like Bolt, might say, I don't need to play this battle globally. I only need to win London, Paris, Amsterdam, and one or two other cities, Munich, for example. And I'm happy being the market leader in those four cities. And and my investors are happy to throw money in terms of customer acquisition costs and hack away at Uber's roots in those cities. And if I had 15 competitors who took on Uber in five cities each across the world, they would essentially take down the entire tree, competing purely on the basis of price.
There's a company called NFX, James Currier, and he will describe, I hope that I'm describing what I'm about to describe well, but there are some, and I think what you described with Amazon Web Services is that it's a case of the more you win, the more you can win. So your moat increases as your size increases and your distance from your competitors increases as your size increases, such that even Google has had a very, very hard time keeping up with, let alone catching up to Amazon, having only started a few years later. By contrast, there are other businesses where the network effects wear off as you get to a certain scale. And so I think that behind what you're talking about in the case of Uber and its competitors is that once you reach a certain scale in a city, you're there and you can provide as good a service in terms of time to customer or time to a ride as your competitor. There's no advantage. So your Uber gets there first, perhaps, but if Lyft gets there a year or two later, now the service that Lyft can provide is exactly the same. And I think that the one engineer that I know at Google who's competing with Amazon Web Services in their cloud service, you know, he would love to be in a position where he just needs to get to the scale that Amazon was 2 years ago and they'd be close to catching up or something like that. But single point of failure business. Just going to... those VC firms, it's I find it extraordinary and unusual, but it is the way the world is right now, it seems, that such a small group of people, and probably the people who work at A16Z and Sequoia and one or two other firms, I mean, that's a community of maybe 100,000 people when you think of all of their investee companies and investors and what have you, and the concentration of insight and knowledge there is absolutely enormous, and they have the world in their sights. So Ninad and I were both at a ValueX in the Middle East, and there was somebody there who spoke called Dennis Hong, who was one of the most inspiring talks for me, other than Ninad's, of course. Ninad, your talk was extremely inspiring. But
amazing, yeah.
Yeah, it was clear to me that he had understood that. And actually what I did when I got back is I had an intern download a list. We got a list of about 1,200 companies, which were in this. We took Index Ventures in Europe, of Sequoia, A16Z, NFX, and obviously many of those investments are common. And then the goal is really just to work through every single one. Warren Buffett talks about starting at the A's. Well, we're going to start at the A16Z, work through NFX and Sequoia, basically. And we'll see where we get to. It was extraordinarily inspiring. So what is your best understanding of why? So on the one hand, you have Charlie Munger, who for good reason says the returns in the VC space for these firms have been extraordinary. He's talked in glowing terms of the culture at these VC firms, that there are meritocracies like one has never seen before, with some of the best people, highly competitive. If you don't perform in multiple different ways, you're not going to make it inside those firms. And if I look at the investments of those firms, many of their investments are in crypto and Web3, while at the same time, Charlie Munger has been utterly disparaging Rat Poison Squared. And Charlie has no doubt gone through the exercise of working through what their investments are to understand. I have no doubt about that. So there's an apparent contradiction there that I'm curious if you can try to explain.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's frankly, for me, that's been, and I'm a big fan of Charlie and Warren. I mean, you know, we go to Omaha together every year when it's possible. And, you know, I think what I've learned about Charlie and Warren is sometimes, and generally your heroes in life, is that you should probably do as they say, not do as they do. Look at what people are saying, because the principles are timeless. And that's what they've done, is they've taken, they have timeless principles. So, and don't focus on the specific necessarily, unless you really want to.
Yeah.
So with Charlie, I mean, I've learned a lot. I don't understand how and why he would be so negative on crypto. My sense is that he probably understands the technology as such. I think he understands the pros, but he's probably not able to pair it with the destabilizing effect that crypto and Web3 will likely have on the world. Because the world has always been classist. Let's, you know, be honest. I mean, there's always been someone who's been the king or the ruler, and there's always been someone in charge, and there's always been the priests, and there's always been order in the world that's been driven through centralization. And fundamentally, crypto is about decentralization. And it's almost anarchy in a way. And the only rule is mathematics and, you know, and the technology that backs it. So I think the prospect of ways in which it could go wrong, which I'm sure he's thought those through and could be disruptive to the world as a whole, is probably something he has not been able to wrap his head around. And, you know, if I were Charlie, I say this to my friends when we talk about this topic, is if Charlie were to spend time with someone like Vitalik Buterin, who is the founder of Ethereum, some of the people in that circle, and mentor them, I mean, that would be an amazing thing. That would be an amazing outcome for humanity, right? If Warren Buffett could have mentored Elon before he went off the rails, I love Elon, by the way, maybe the world would have been a better place.
What makes you think Elon's off the rails?
No, I don't think he's off the rails. I mean, I think I'm just joking, because that's how he comes across. I mean, listen, I listened to him talk on Lex Fridman a few days ago on Lex Fridman's podcast, and another amazing podcast. You know, the guy is the thing that people don't realize about Elon. One of the things is that he is the chief engineer of SpaceX, which means he's 100% responsible for shuttle launches and recovery. When people argue with Elon's brain power and his absolute desire to see the impossible become possible, he's talking about being on Mars in sort of between 5 to 10 years. It's incredible to see that drive, and as much as he comes across as a misanthrope
he's actually doing it because he wants to see the human species survive and become multiplanetary, as he calls it. So, I mean, people just don't get that. So, you know, I usually just talk to people assuming that they have, they know none of these things about Elon.
I, you know, for what it's worth, I've never owned Tesla. I've never shorted Tesla. I have enormous respect for, I mean, look, there is absolutely no way that anybody can make the claim that the planet would have been better off without Elon. Elon is an incredible asset to the planet in a thousand different ways. He's one of the most extraordinary beings who's walked the planet. There's no question about that. I'm going to give my 2 cents worth on Charlie and crypto. And then I'm going to kind of close off with, I want you to kind of give like the Nanad special sources of information, and I'll get to that. But I'm just going to take the opportunity to sound off myself for a second. I don't see there's any contradiction for Charlie and the crypto world. And here's how I see it. And you didn't ask me the question, but I feel compelled to say it. So I think that Charlie understands crypto. He understands its revolutionary nature. I think that he knows that half the planet or a huge proportion of the planet hangs on his every word. And for an enormous number of people to just bless crypto will result in them losing enormous amounts of money, because I do believe that there are very significant parts of the crypto world that will eventually be worth zero. So there are, I think that the word is shit coins, and there are 16,000 of them. And so I think it's entirely consistent for Charlie Munger when he's talking, and he has to assume that every time he opens his mouth, he's talking for a general audience, that for a general audience, he does the most good by saying most likely, and he says most likely rat poison squared, because there is a significant amount of rat poison there. While at the same time, If you're the right kind of analyst who's got an engineering or a clear thinking background, who wants to dive into the detail of what is going on and pick specific spots to allocate perhaps some of your resources, time, energy, money, then that can certainly make sense. And so I don't see that there's any contradiction there. I don't see that why you can't say it's the most revolutionary thing on the planet going today other than Elon, while at the same time saying that vast portions of that universe are enormous bubbles that are going to collapse and tread at your own will. And I find the people who diss it equally annoying as the ones who that's all they want to talk about. And I'm super fascinated by the people, and we have a few of them at ValueX, who are just really fascinated and want to use their intellect to try and understand and make sense of it. And I think the great news with Web 3.0 and crypto is that we're still at the very, very early days. It's still unfolding so rapidly and in such unusual and unexpected ways that you know, just watch this space type of deal. Bitcoin was the very, very beginning. It's not the end. That's kind of the opening scene, but there's many, many scenes to this. One of the things that I've had to learn is that, so you can imagine, Nanad, I'll give you a bit of a rest by sounding off on something else. Analyzing financial statements, which are basically backward looking, and all of the knowledge and experience that I gained over 20 years of analyzing financial statements are not very helpful if you plan on focusing on this very narrow. It's helpful in all sorts of ways. Helpful if you're doing traditional private equity, many different ways that it's helpful. But if you want to focus on this very unusual part of the investing universe, which is these companies where there's overlapping super high returns and overlapping economics that work in your favor, then you need different sources. And perhaps you can run down that list of sources that you use. Over you talked about podcasts, so I'll just repeat for you so you know what I'm talking about. We have Muji Hypergrowth, which is a website. We have podcasts in general. You talked about the Lex Fridman podcast. What other sources do you like?
Yeah, sure. Happy to elaborate on that. So there's a long list. Actually, it's in that presentation. I don't know if you do show notes with the podcast, but if you do, then I'm happy to share
that list, but you know,
I'll save your voice, Ninad. I'm gonna read out a few of them, and we'll certainly share them in the show notes. There's Stratechery, Hypergrowth, Software Stack Investing, Ark Invest, Matthew Ball. There's a show called The Pivot Show, Loop Ventures. So I'll get those out there, and it's far better for me to just get them out there than for you to have to sound them out.
These have been around for a long time, I think it's an immersive experience. It's a bit like, you know, for you to have faith in God, you need to have a personal relationship with God, right? So it's a bit like that with these things, is that you need to spend your time in the scriptures and learning from the source code, rather. When I'm having this conversation with people who are at the other end of the spectrum in terms of sort of, you know, not wanting to think about growth and tech and SaaS and things of that nature, the one thing I say to them is, you know, no two paths are going to be the same. And we know that as, you know, investors, like no two investors have had the same path of learning. There's no canon, you know, there's nothing canonical about it. So you have to immerse yourself in it, and all the organic connections, neural connections will form themselves. And I find personally that the easiest way to do that is through podcasts, because people love to talk. There's been an Cambrian explosion of podcasts in the past few years. And for example, the A16Z, those are good ones. That's a good one. Stratechery has a podcast. Muji has a podcast or talks on his premium site. I would say if you're into crypto, there's another podcast called Bankless, which is they basically have the who's who of the crypto world and the non-crypto world. I'm lately listening to everything that this guy named Balaji Srinivasan has ever said. He was a partner at A16Z, but now he's off doing some other stuff. He was former CTO at Coinbase also. But I mean, he is, for example, a Renaissance thinker. He's multidisciplinary in how he thinks of the world. And whatever he thinks is sort of 10, 15, 20 years out. And I know you say, well, what do we do with that? I need to invest today and have returns from investors in the next sort of few years. What's 15 years out? Tell me. But I mean, the thing is that all these things that we are seeing today, while the world is distracted by the pandemic, the rest of the world is building new things and rebuilding old things. And we don't see that as much. We need to find the stuff that is on the trajectory of this runway, which will last for the next 15 or 20 years.
Ninad, if people hear this and they're inspired by getting in touch with you, how should they find you? What are the best ways to find you?
Well, I spend most of my time on Instagram. I'm joking about that. But
I thought that was serious. I was thinking, oh my God, I got to follow you.
Well, I mean, I'm happy to, if you were to share my email information in your show notes, which I think you have it. It's ninad.a.shinde@gmail.com.
Got it. We'll share it with brackets around the apps that you don't use. People actually have to type it in before they get to you, but that's great.
That's great. I am on Twitter, but at the same time, I'm not very vocal on Twitter. I mainly use it to complain about the bad service I get from my utilities provider.
Have you blocked anyone recently? Have you seen the recent spat between Jack Dorsey and...
Luckily, Jack was not following me, so then I didn't have to block him.
In any case, Ninad, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like there's so much to learn from you. At our ValueX group, there's a specific room called the Ninad's Room, where we just get to sort of sit there and eat the fruit of Ninad's thoughts. And it's an enormous amount of fun. And I'm really grateful to you for appearing on this one of the Cambrian explosion of podcasts. I realized it wasn't a bad thing to do a podcast, and it's a real privilege and pleasure to have you on here. Thank you.
Likewise. And thank you for hosting us, and thank you for seeding this ValueX family.
Exactly.